Hi everyone, today we're going to be reading the East Boston Times Free Press. This edition is from Wednesday, December 17th, 2025. Planning Department hosts meeting after former EB Police A7 station. By Michael Coughlin Jr. Last week, the Planning Department hosted a meeting about the old A7 East Boston Police Station at 69 Paris Street, which is undergoing a disposition process to be rehabilitated. The focus of last week's meeting was to review the draft development objectives, design guidelines, and evaluation criteria for rehabilitation of the former A7 police station, said Scott Greenhall, a real estate development officer with the planning department. This meeting follows one that was held in April, where residents shared their ideas for the rehabilitation of the building, which was initially built in 1912, had a third story added in 1930, and is currently attached to a courthouse owned by the Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance, DCAM, at 37 Meridian Street. It should be noted that the project webpage on the Planning Department's website notes that the courthouse is not a part of the future RFP request for proposals. Before getting to the objectives of this meeting, Greenhalgh provided a recap of April's meeting, covering topics such as site history, the disposition process, DCAM's involvement, and more. The above topics were covered in a story about that meeting in the May 7th edition of the East Boston Times Free Press. The common thread in that conversation was an emphasis on community use, whether that be for nonprofits, community organizations, cultural space, art space, or even a museum, said Greenhalgh of the discussion at April's meeting. Housing also was briefly discussed as a possibility here, he added. Based on the above feedback, the planning department has crafted development objectives to guide an upcoming RFP. Today, we're seeking feedback on these development objectives and the next few slides, Greenhalgh said. The objectives per the meeting slideshow are to allow for a mix of uses, having historic preservation serve as a public destination, and to have resilient design. Moreover, Greenhalgh outlined the area's zoning regulations for coastal resilience, sustainability, and green building guidelines, as well as building dimensions. Specifically, the site is in the mixed-use 5, MU5, zoning subdistrict, meaning the building's maximum height under zoning would be 5 stories or 65 feet. The building is currently 3.5 stories and about 43 feet. Proposals should preserve the historic structure, and any addition should align with the character of the existing building, as well as any surrounding buildings, Greenhalgh said. Improved public space will be key as well. As the meeting progressed, draft evaluation criteria for future proposals that focus on demonstration of ability to execute the project, as presented in Strength of Financial Plan, Development Program, Exceptional Design and Public Realm, and Diversity and Inclusion Plan were revealed. Potential subsidies and resources for the proponent who was eventually selected to rehabilitate the site were also shared, including the Community Preservation Act, historic tax credits, and more. These programs are not offered in the RFP, and they'd require a separate application to each of them, Greenhalgh said. As for the next steps in the RFP process, Greenhalgh said it would be to release a draft RFP anticipated in the spring. A final RFP would then be released following the draft. Following the presentation, the floor was opened to attendees for questions and comments. One attendee asked about one of the development objectives, to create a public destination, which the slideshow presentation stated could be something that attracts visitors. In response, Greenhalgh said, "I think that speaks more to being attractive to people who would visit the site or users of the building, and also in the sense of a public realm that is inviting." Another attendee asked, "Who assesses the responses to the final RFP and decides on a proposal?" That would be a team at the city, including me and other colleagues in urban design, our transportation planning team, Greenhalgh said. We would provide input on the RFP proposals, but also all the developers that respond to the RFP, and we feel that we are qualified responders in the sense that they meet the minimum submission requirements. They would present in a community meeting a few weeks later after the RFPs are received, he added, noting that the community will be involved in providing feedback on proposals as well. As the discussion continued, several other topics, including the condition of the building, its historical status, using the space for young folks, DCAM's involvement, and potentially adopting a slower, more involved community process, were raised. To view a recording of the presentation and discussion, and for more information about this project, visit www.bostonplans.org/planning-zoning /planning-initiatives/A-7-East-Boston-Police-Station. Letter to the editor. Donations needed. To the editor. An appeal came into the chamber from East Boston's own Meridian House for donations such as clothing, shoes, coats, hygiene, blankets, and or food for the residents. With the holidays quickly approaching, any of these would be greatly appreciated, and contact information is below. Please pass on this request to your networks to help in this time of need. Thank you for your help and support. East Boston Chamber of Commerce. The East Boston Times Free Press Forum. The mass shooting in Australia. Shocking, but sadly not surprising. This past weekend's tragic shooting in Australia at a Hanukkah festival once again has demonstrated to the world the pernicious and evil effects of anti-Semitism, which is the world's oldest form of prejudice. Anti-Semitism may have reached its peak with the Holocaust and Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, but it still remains the number one source of hate in the world today. In the United States, acts of anti-Semitism have spiked exponentially in the past 10 years, long predating the war in Gaza. According to the Anti-Defamation League, there were 9,354 anti-Semitic incidents in 2024, the highest number since it began tracking the data in 1979, representing a 344% increase over the past 5 years and an 893% increase over the past decade. The stark nature and depth of anti-Semitism in our country was on full display in the August 2017 white nationalist demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, when a group of white supremacists marched with candles chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." New York City's police commissioner, Jessica Tisch, speaking on Sunday about the shooting in Australia, unequivocally stated the extent of the scourge of anti-Semitism. "This is not an isolated incident. It is part of a wider assault on Jewish life. Jewish communities are being forced to confront a threat that is persistent, adaptive, and as evidenced yet again today, global in scope. Every synagogue and temple in our country now has armed security guards, something that would have been unimaginable even 10 years ago. Up until this past weekend, Bondi Beach in Sydney has been a world-famous destination, known for its surf and long stretch of beautiful beach, but now will be forever remembered as a place where scores of innocent people were gunned down for one reason and one reason only. They were Jews. A long, hard winter lies ahead. We don't need a weatherman to tell us that the first part of December has been unusually cold, so it was not at all surprising when we recently read that it has been the coldest start to December in our area in 17 years. We've been pretty fortunate in our part of the world to have had mild Decembers for quite a while. Winter isn't that tough to take when it's only the months of January and February that dish out wintry weather. We recall that even the snowmageddon winter of 2015 was really not all that bad. We had about 6 weeks of record-breaking snowfall, 115 inches, but that was it, although the mounds of snow lingered until well into the spring on playgrounds and parking lots. Last winter was oppressive for most of January and February. The daily high temperatures barely broke 30, and the wind chills every morning were in the single digits. But we had plenty of sunshine, and that made our daily run on the sandbar near our home at low tide easy enough to take. We would even go so far as to say that enduring 6 or 7 weeks of blustery winter days makes us feel alive and truly appreciative of the nicer weather when it arrives. But these last 3 weeks of below normal temperatures since Thanksgiving have broken the recent patterns of easing us into winter. Winter's grip already feels oppressive thanks to the cold and constant winds that have sent the wind chills dipping into the low single and even below zero digits. In addition, the sun has been absent more often than not. And with our heating bills already going through the roof, spring seems like a long, long time away. Uber drivers worried about lack of safety protocols, by Ariel Appleby. After a passenger looped a wire around an Uber driver's neck and cinched it tight last month, police say the woman broke free and bolted from her car, screaming as she burst into the closest store in sight, pleading for someone to call 911. While sitting at a red light at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Columbus Avenue in Boston's South End, police say Christopher Dawkins, 24, of Dorchester, looped a wire around an Uber driver's neck and strangled her, and then stole her car after she escaped. Dawkins pleaded not guilty during his arraignment on carjacking, strangulation, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, and larceny of a motor vehicle charges in Boston Municipal Court on November 27th. He was ordered to be held without bail. For rideshare drivers, especially women and people of color, attacks are an occupational hazard they live with every shift. Car accidents, unruly passengers, and verbal harassment are ever-present threats, but many vulnerable drivers say they feel like they are risking their lives each time they slide behind the wheel. According to an April 2023 Strategic Organizing Center report, which was working with the Rideshare Drivers Union about the safety concerns of rideshare drivers, 67% of rideshare driver respondents reported having experienced some kind of violence, harassment, or threatening behavior in the last year. The attack in Boston is one of many cautionary tales for rideshare drivers, especially those who are women or people of color. Attackers typically target those they believe are the most vulnerable. 79% of app-based drivers have felt unsafe, and female drivers experience higher rates of sexual harassment, according to researchers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Many Lyft and Uber drivers depend on their jobs to provide for their families, and researchers say they often fear that intervening and speaking up may lower their ratings and endanger their jobs. When I walk into a union meeting, it's like walking into the pages of a giant John Steinbeck novel, said Dwayne Mitchell, curator of the Massachusetts Drivers United website. They're really vulnerable and extremely exploited people, especially since a lot of them don't speak English. Mitchell's prior experience as a Boston cab driver versus an Uber driver illustrates what he says is a stark difference in safety standards. I had to take safety classes with trainings by the Boston police before I could get my cab driver's license, said Mitchell. There is a bulletproof partition separating you from the driver and cabs, but Uber doesn't care. There's none of that. Beyond the issue of Uber's lack of safety protocols, Mitchell said there is simultaneously a lack of community within rideshare drivers. As a cabbie, he said there was a sense of togetherness, and drivers would alert each other about potential dangers. Many of us had an extra radio in our cab just to speak with other drivers. We had two radios going on, one for the cab company and the other to speak with each other, he said. We heard stories all the time, and were always aware of the potential danger. Uber doesn't make space for that camaraderie, according to Mitchell, which leads to isolation and fear of self-reporting incidents by drivers. Attacks on rideshare drivers are rare in Boston, he said, but one wrong ride can change people's perception of the risk. People are nice all over Boston, Mitchell said, but all it takes is one lunatic. Ariel Appleby is a student in the Boston University Journalism Program. This story is a partnership between the Times Free Press and the Boston University Journalism Program. City Council hearings identify operational issues within Boston Police Department, by Kiran Rajamani. An analysis of 10 months of Boston City Council hearings reveals that city councilors have repeatedly and consistently raised concerns about overtime spending, staffing levels, crime lab operations, and a discriminatory promotion system at the city's police department. An investigation by Boston University's student newspaper, the Daily Free Press, revealed more than 200 instances of BPD-related concerns expressed during public meetings between January 1, 2024 and October 1, 2025. Nearly 1,000 hours of city council hearings and committee meetings were reviewed using artificial intelligence. Each instance was manually verified. BPD did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Overtime spending exceeds budgeted levels. City Councilor Benjamin Weber said BPD overtime spending has exceeded its budget allocation for multiple fiscal years. In 2024, the department blew through its roughly $40 million overtime budget by about $50 million, according to council hearings. Weber said the City Council has oversight of BPD's budget, but does not impose a firm cap on overtime hours because of public safety needs, court requirements, and security needs during special events. Some overtime policies contribute to higher costs, Weber said, including a rule that provides a four-hour minimum overtime payment for certain court appearances, even if officers spend only a short time before a judge. Some officers make $300,000 to $400,000 a year, primarily from overtime, Weber said. Weber added that overtime rules are governed by collective bargaining agreements negotiated between police unions and the mayor's office, which limit the council's power to rein in spending. Staffing levels contribute to overtime use. City Councilor Ed Flynn said staffing shortages drive overtime spending. At a May 2024 council meeting, police officials said an average of 131 officers leave the force each year, and only 108 are hired, resulting in a net decline. Because of the significant staff shortages, Flynn said, we are forcing police officers to work mandatory overtime, consistently 16-hour days. He said he has raised the issue during multiple budget cycles, citing concerns about officer fatigue and safety. The staffing shortfall requires the department to rely on overtime to maintain patrol coverage, according to statements made during hearings. Crime lab leadership and processing delays discussed. Counselors also raised concerns about the operational capacity of Boston Police Crime Laboratory during hearings in 2024 and 2025. The crime lab conducts DNA testing, rape kit analysis, firearms examinations, and other forensic work used in criminal investigations. During an April 2024 committee meeting, Flynn said the lab failed to test approximately half of all rape kits within the state-mandated 30-day timeframe during fiscal year 2023. Flynn proposed a $1 million budget increase for fiscal year 2025 to fund staffing, fill the director position, and purchase updated equipment. While the city council approved the funding, Flynn said as of September 2025 hearing that he had not yet seen measurable improvements. "I'm not confident in the Boston Police Crime Labs and their leadership," Flynn said during the hearing, citing the prolonged vacancy and delayed adoption of newer DNA testing methods used by other jurisdictions. Federal court ruled promotional exams discriminatory. Testimony during a January 2025 Government Accountability, Transparency, and Accessibility Committee hearing addressed the history of police promotional exams using statewide, including by BPD. Retired BPD Detective Larry Ellison referenced a 2023 federal court decision that awarded more than $40 million to officers of color across Massachusetts. The court ruled that the exam used to grant promotions systemically penalized Black and Latino officers in violation of state anti-discrimination laws. The court found that the exams relied heavily on multiple-choice testing that did not adequately measure supervisory skills, which produced statistically significant racial disparities. Judges also ruled the state has been aware of the disparities for years and failed to adopt available alternatives. Ellison testified that concerns about retaliation discouraged some officers from reporting inequities or pursuing leadership positions, describing his own experience after becoming president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers. City Councilor Henry Santana, chair of the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Committee, said the hearings underscored the importance of council oversight. Oversight isn't about criticism, it's about ensuring that policies, investigations, and practices reflect fairness and integrity, Santana said in a written statement. We strengthen public safety when we address issues openly and work toward solutions that protect all residents. Kiran Rajamani is a student in the Boston University Journalism Program. This story is a partnership between the Times Free Press and the Boston University Journalism Program. Healy Driscoll administration awards over $750,000 in grants to support greater food access in Massachusetts, special to the Times Free Press. The Healy Driscoll administration announced $779,458 in funding to improve food access in underserved communities throughout Massachusetts by increasing local food production. The funding will directly support the growth of urban farms, community gardens, and food business operations, targeting areas that struggle with food insecurity. Among the recipients are $20,979 to trustees of reservations for improving pathways for senior and mobility-challenged garden implements, and $85,000 to Commonwealth Kitchen for their large-scale, specialized food processing equipment. The Massachusetts Department of Agricultural Resources, MDAR, is awarding grants through the state's Urban Agriculture Program and the Massachusetts Food Ventures Program to 17 organizations. The funds will help strengthen the local food system, increase local food production, and expand retail and distribution channels to distribute more healthy, fresh food across the state. With President Trump repeatedly attacking the programs that help Massachusetts families afford food, programs like these will increase the supply of locally grown, healthy, affordable food, said Governor Maura Healey. These awards are supporting local jobs, farmers, and small food businesses that keep money circulating in our local economy and provide essential food for the people of Massachusetts. Investing in community gardens and urban farms gives neighborhoods more control over their own food supply, said Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll. These projects increase consistent access to fresh and local produce, create real opportunities for skill building, and help communities build reliable distribution systems. The Urban Agriculture Program will provide resources to urban farms and community gardens to increase their production capacity. This means more local food for low to moderate income residents who often face challenges accessing fresh, affordable, nutritious food. The Massachusetts Food Ventures Program helps increase food access by funding infrastructure to support processing, distribution channels, and retail outlets that are located primarily in or near communities of low or moderate income, including gateway cities and rural communities. Completed projects will enhance access to Massachusetts-grown, harvested, or caught food products through the development of collaborations with local agricultural enterprises and public/private entities. Fresh, affordable food is a basic need for our communities across Massachusetts, said Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Rebecca Tepper. Programs like urban agriculture and food ventures strengthen our local food system by increasing production and distribution capacity as demand for local food continues to grow. Our food access programs have been transformative in helping to create a stronger local food system, said MDAR Commissioner Ashley Randall. The Food Ventures program provides opportunities for mid-range businesses, creating greater access to Massachusetts-grown food and increasing post-harvest opportunities for farmers. Through the urban agriculture program, more food will be grown in urban neighborhoods, helping to ensure that residents in these communities have greater access to local fresh produce, improving their health outcomes and enhancing their quality of life. I am glad to see the release of this grant funding, particularly to two organizations in Springfield, Wellspring Harvest, and Nordico St. Street Community Farm, who do such great work uniting our communities and providing healthy food and nutritional education to their members, said Senator Adam Gomez, a Democrat of Hampton. We must continue to invest in community-centered food resources throughout the Commonwealth, shortening the distance that our food travels and mitigating gaps in supply chain that only drive up prices, and I'm proud of this administration for prioritizing these efforts. I'm thrilled to see much needed help during these troubling economic times, said Representative Stephen Ouellette, a Democrat of Westport. This funding will provide opportunities that are critical components to communities in my district and beyond. Deck the Windows winners, special to the Times Free Press. The East Boston Chamber of Commerce invited the businesses of East Boston to participate in its annual window decorating contest, Deck the Windows. To participate, local businesses decorated their windows or facades with seasonal decorations. The Chamber's board voted the following winners. First place award went to Bono Restaurant and Catering at 271 Meridian Street. Second place award went to Spinelli's Pasta and Pastry Shop at 282 Bennington Street. And third place award went to Century 21 Mario Real Estate at 620 Bennington Street. Prizes will be given in person this week to the winners and announced at the Chamber's annual holiday gathering on December 16th at 464 Bremen Street. Prizes include certificates, letters and cash prizes. The Chamber wishes to thank all of the businesses that decorated for the holidays, adding to the beauty of our community and to the festive cheer. East Boston brothers face dangerousness hearings after narcotics bust, special to the Times Free Press. Two East Boston brothers were arraigned Wednesday in BMC East Boston on charges of drug possession and distribution after a months-long surveillance operation by Boston Police, Suffolk District Attorney Kevin Hayden announced. Julian Mangu Ebriel, 33, is charged with trafficking cocaine over 200 grams, possessing with intent to distribute Class A, two counts of possession with intent to distribute Class B, possession with intent to distribute Class C, possession with intent to distribute Class D, and drug violation near school/park. Judge Deborah DelVecchio ordered him held without bail pending a December 16th dangerousness hearing. Juan Mangu Ebriel, 30, is charged with trafficking cocaine over 200 grams, possession with intent to distribute Class B, possession with intent to distribute Class D, and a drug violation near school/park. DelVecchio set bail at $1,500 and ordered him to return to court December 19th for a dangerousness hearing. Earlier this year, Boston police received complaints about drug activity in the Greenway area near Maverick Square in East Boston. After extensive surveillance and controlled undercover drug purchases, police identified Julian Mogil Abriel as one of the main dealers and obtained a search warrant for his person and his 60 Lubeck Street residence in East Boston. On December 9th, drug control unit officers from areas A1, A7, and E18 arrested Julian Mangue Abril on his first floor landing of his Lubeck Street apartment building. Officers entered the home and arrested Juan, Julian's younger brother, inside. Prior to the search warrant being executed, Julian stated that everything in his bedroom belonged to him personally. Juan also stated that everything found in his bedroom belonged to him personally. Officers seized $11,000 in cash, a half kilo of cocaine, several pounds of marijuana, psychedelic mushrooms, LSD, ketamine, and MDMA from both bedrooms and the kitchen. The brothers' residence is located 199 feet from the boundary line of the Donald McKay Elementary School. This was a long and thorough investigation that began through communication from residents concerned about what they saw happening in their neighborhood. Quality of life is of utmost importance for all of our residents. And this episode is a good example of what can happen when residents share with law enforcement what they're seeing on their streets and in their neighborhoods, Hayden said. All charged individuals are presumed innocent until and unless proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden's office serves the communities of Boston, Chelsea, Revere, and Winthrop. Our office handles more than 20,000 cases a year. Nearly 160 assistant district attorneys practice in 9 district and municipal courts, Suffolk Superior Court, the Massachusetts Appeals Court, the Boston and Chelsea Juvenile Courts, and the Supreme Judicial Court. Our office employs some 300 people and offers a wide range of services and programs for anyone encountering the criminal justice system. We are committed to educating the public about our mission and services while focusing on crime prevention to help the residents, workers, and visitors of Suffolk County feel safe.